Some time ago, I ended up corresponding with an individual that decided that the way we were keeping the calendar, the way we were doing things, was inappropriate, that we should rather be following the vernal equinox, this type of reckoning of equal day and night. And it's a problem. There are papers being shared. There are studies being presented. And one thing that I had brought up was the idea that these zodiacal type of things that are clearly in ancient societies, in which can be looked at today, even without the paganism, is still stemming from things that we want to stay away from. And when we look at Scripture, I mean, when we look at what Yahweh instructs of us, we find that there are specific instructions. In fact, we read Numbers chapter 5 today. And in that is some instructions showing that we are to be separate, that there is a clean versus the unclean. Even in Leviticus 10, in verse 10, it says that. So Yahweh is concerned, and he has specific instructions for us. It's interesting, there is even a waving of the grain. And we'll talk a little bit about a wave sheaf today. But hopefully we'll be able to get to it. I've asked Carrie to time me on this, and this may go into a part two. But we'll see how it goes. I've been doing a lot of research and finding a lot of reliable resources showing just where zodiac astrological reckonings come from, and the division of the winter solstice and spring equinox and all this comes from. One thing that's significant is we don't find it in Scripture. That is, we don't find any specific instructions to divide the day and then in the night for the beginning of the year. It's just not there. But what we do find is very interesting. There's something else that was mentioned in Numbers 5. Well, I guess the thing that got my attention on Numbers chapter 5 is the idea that there are some teachings that Yahweh expects that seem a little different. Well, the calendar that we observe is a little different than what you find out in the world. And so it shouldn't be any surprise. Yahweh has his way, and the world has its. Let's, I don't know if you have a calendar in your Bible. I happen to have one in the back. And I just want to refer to it. It's, if you happen to have a Ryries, it's map number 8. And it's showing the Babylonian Empire. And it covers basically the Middle East. And if you can think of the Middle East with the Sinai Peninsula just right of Egypt there, and going further to the right, you find Arab areas. And northeast, you find Israel. And you go further south, and you'll find where Abraham came from, or where Abram came from, because his name was changed. But he was called out from Ur of the Sumerian area there, which is just above the Persian Gulf. And it's down towards the end of the Euphrates-Tigris River, as you would see on a map. But this is basically what historians would call the cradle of mankind. Basically, history all points back, at least for this area, points back to this particular area where the city of Ur is. And the city of Ur is basically a pagan city. It was a pagan society. Sumeria, basically, however you want to pronounce it, was pagan, was a pagan society. And it looks like Adam and Eve, their descendants, ended up really falling away for the most part. But Yahweh was going to rectify things, but in his own timing. In looking at the calendar, I was wondering why, when Judah went to Babylon, why is it that Daniel didn't set the calendar straight there? And I found an answer going back in Daniel. I think it's Daniel chapter 8, if you want to turn there with me. Maybe it's Daniel Daniel 6. Daniel 6 and verse 8. It says, "The king established the injunction and signed the document so that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked." In other words, once a law was established, you couldn't change it. Now, it's interesting. When we go back to the area of Samaria and into Babylon, we find that they had certain regulations concerning the calendar, certain things that they did. And we can take a look at that. But one thing that I realize is hard for some people to understand is, well, they look at Genesis 1, verse 14, which talks about the sun and the stars and the moon. And we find that the moon, that which is supposed to be seen here come Tuesday, which is over in the western sky, before, well, after sunset, we should be able to see that thin visible crescent, that first light through the phases of that moon. And it's a cyclical cycle that goes through its a period of 29.5 to 30 days, to be fairly precise on it. And so we go out and we look to the western sky, and we see whether or not this new moon shows. And it's pretty well documented. We don't have to do a lot of digging before we find Hebrew historians noting that that's exactly what it is. It's the first visible crescent. It's not a calculation of man that comes to the forefront and was observed by the Hebrews. And when we consider the pattern of the moon and these other things, we do see a clock-like working. We see, even within the galaxy, the rotation going all the way down into creation of subatomic particles. There's a rotation that's occurring. I suppose if we wanted to, we could tell time just by the rotation. You figure so many rotations within a day, or, for example, you could divide that and come up with some sort of timetable. But the Bible tells us from creation that the weekly pattern is basically made up of 7 days, and that we're told to come and rest on the seventh day. Actually, we're told that Yahweh rested on the seventh day. Beyond that, we're really not told too much else about the Sabbath. One of the problems with just going with Genesis 1:14 in Scripture is, that's not all the information there is. And there's a lot of information we could go into. And we're not going to be able to cover everything today. So it's going to be basically a focus on pagan calendars. I really want to bring this home, showing the history and what they did in ancient times before Israel was ever a nation. But it's interesting to see the patterns. I do think that because of the patterns, that common sense would say, well, we should be able to tell what the year is by looking at the constellations and seeing the ecliptical, or the line of the sun, and being able to discern all this. Well, it becomes kind of complicated. While the week and the month are easily known through visible observation, to figure the year by using the celestial bodies is as complex as a task can be. Dr. Nick Thorpe, an archaeologist in prehistory, and Peter James, a writer of ancient history and archaeology, wrote in Ancient Inventions, "At a very early date, mankind would have had at its disposal accurate knowledge of both the moon's phases and the length of the year, enough to devise a workable calendar. One might think, however, that's where the real difficulties began. The intrinsic problem with old calendars is that our superficially harmonious solar system is actually a complete jumble. One revolution of the Earth on its axis makes a day, but 365 of these revolutions are not equal to the time it takes for the Earth to orbit around the Sun, that is, 1 year, which amounts to 365.242199 days. Likewise, the lunar month is not a round figure. It is actually 29.53059 days. And while there are roughly 12 lunar months in a year, they add up to only 354.36706 days, 11 days short of the solar year. Try taking all these factors into account in one system and you will have quite a headache. Devising a calendar that works has thus been one of mankind's longest quests. Very insightful. Now, you know, Israel came out of Egypt. Well, Egypt had a calendar. Actually, they had two calendars. No, wait. They actually had three calendars. They had basically two religious calendars. They had a civil calendar, which was basically they looked at the Nile River for that one. Maybe we can get into that a little bit. But Egypt was known to have at least two calendars at one point, and they were used side by side. In the Encyclopedia of Ancient Egypt by Margaret Bunsen, she writes that they would not just set something aside so venerable, preferring to adjust their enterprises to the new calendar while maintaining the old. Now, the first Egyptian calendar ran into problems with the seasons getting out of alignment. They helped the problems by adding on 5 days to the second calendar each year. But like I've said, they've kept that other calendar as well. So they went forward with these two calendars. Now, adjustments like this seem to be the practice of almost every civilization trying to come up with an accurate calendar. Noted as a slipping calendar in Ancient Inventions, the book, which is a great little book. There's a wealth of information in this, and I picked it up for like $5. A great find. And it's interesting how it was found. It's like Yahweh, you know, pointed me in the way because of certain events that took place. I don't want to get into all that happened, but I'd never been in this particular bookstore before, and it was like I was forced to go there. So just interesting how Yahweh provides the materials and what we need. And I happen to be looking into this subject matter, so it's quite good to have gotten a hold of this one particular book. But this book, Ancient Inventions, says the Egyptians, like other ancient Near Eastern peoples, including the Sumerians, the Babylonians, and the Jews, made regular calendar reforms to keep things in step. They made regular calendar reforms to keep everything in step. Would Yahweh present to us a calendar that we would have to figure out by intercalation, that is to add days or, you know, a month, would, you know, by our own figuring, would he give us such a calendar? It's hard to believe that he would. You know, the Chinese, you've heard of the Chinese New Year? How about the Chinese New Year? New Year, New Year, New Year, New Year, New Year, New Year. Because they went through 100 revisions on their calendar. In the same book, it says, in ancient China, the surviving oracle bones used by the rulers of the Shang Dynasty to foretell the future show that the Chinese had a lunar calendar similar to that of the Sumerians. Later on, the importance of having a reliable calendar grew after it became tied to astrology, and one of the emperor's prime responsibilities was to ensure that the calendar was running accurately. Accordingly, around 100 calendrical reforms were initiated by the imperial court. Page 490. Well, enter the zodiac. We find, or historians have found, ancient cylinders from Sumer, Sumeria. They've found a number of tablets from Babylon, the Babylonian Empire. Very interesting stuff. In the Baker Encyclopedia of the Bible, it shows clearly some of the pagan worship. Here we find, it says, the earliest known account of the use of astrology comes from ancient Sumer, or Sumra, Sumerian society. I might just mention that it looks like some historians kind of blend Babylon in with that, because I've read that the earliest zodiac is from Babylon. Well, that I mean, technically, no, but in general, yes. But it goes on here to say in the Baker Encyclopedia of the Bible, the earliest known account of the use of astrology comes from ancient Sumer, a region in the lower Euphrates River Valley. The Sumerian Gudea cylinders contain an account of a dream of King Gudea in which the goddess Nidaba came to him holding a tablet inscribed with a map of the heavens. The dream indicated that it was a propitious or a good time for the Gudea to build the Enennu temple. Astrology flourished in ancient Babylon under the influence of priests. It was intricately linked with the serious study of celestial phenomena. The superstitious Babylonians were intensely concerned with the omens, so it is understandable that they would attempt to find omens in the advisable movements of the sun, moon, planets, and stars. To the best of our knowledge, the Babylonians originated the zodiac. They also drew up a monthly calendar of days that were propitious or helpful in the days on which activity would be reduced to a minimum for fear of incurring the anger of one or more deities. So in other words, the Babylonians were freaked out by the sun, moon, and stars. And, you know, they would have. In history, we find that ancient societies saw omens like the comet being, you know, it's a sign that there's going to be disaster. The Babylonians specifically believe that the kings, at least it's been said, that the kings would actually switch out during a time of eclipse, because they could figure out when the eclipses would occur. They would get the king out of his position just for that momentary time, put someone else in that position, because it was seen as something bad for an omen against the king. So he had these type of weird beliefs back at this time. You know, I can see why Yahweh took the Tower of Babel and just, you know, scattered the people, because they were heading in this direction. They wanted to make a name for themselves. And you find these societies doing the same thing. King Nebuchadnezzar even thought he was quite something until Yahweh showed him who was boss. Made him eat grass 7 years, I think it was. Well, both the pre-Israelite nations of Egyptians and ancient Babylonians could divide the heavens into a type of zodiacal chart to find bad omens and other signs via the ecliptical pattern of the sun, etc. But does the Bible point to such a known chart? The only thing that I could really find that was of substance going back in ancient times, we know Job is one of the oldest books, considered one of the oldest books there is. The timing of it shows a very early date, time of Job. But in Job 9:9, you can turn there, there's actually mention of constellations. In fact, I think even in Revelation we find some constellations mentioned. We're going back to Job. Such an old book here, I'm having a hard time finding it. Job 9:9, chapter 9 and verse 9. It says, who makes, in this, says, who makes the bear, Orion, and Pleiades, and the chambers of the south? Most scholars recognize these are constellations. In fact, it says here in a note by Ryrie's, bear, Orion, and Pleiades, constellations. You know, Yahweh basically states in Job 38, 31, 32, the same constellations. I haven't been able to find these three constellations in any type of zodiac, with the exception of possibly Orion. That's the only one that showed in one. But it does indicate that they knew about these back at that time. In early civilization, as we've already pinpointed, historians have pinpointed, go back to this cradle of history in the Mediterranean. And it looks to be an area where they believe Adam and Eve's, or the Garden of Eden was, where Adam and Eve was. So interesting tidbits there. But it's noteworthy to point out that the earliest zodiac charts and the Sumerian culture had six divisions of constellations with two seasons, spring and fall. Babylonian charts had 18 divisions and also 12, depending on the time period that you look back at their writings. But they seem to keep with a seasonal pattern of two. Assyria, further north, had three. And Egypt, as already mentioned, within their civil year, seemed to have three. But based upon the Nile's annual water levels of flooding, absence, and flow. In fact, watched something recently where they had markings, evidently, for the water levels of the Nile. And at times they would not be able to grow anything because of the flood. Would just flood the field. When the floods left, they were happy. And of course, they had all these deities, sun deity, the pharaohs were deities. Everything was a deity. Stars, sun, moon, they worshipped all of them. And when we think of the different societies, there's even one ancient society that had 13 divisions of the constellations that they could come up with. And it may have been because they just had 13 zoo-like animals that they worship. When I say zoo-like animals, it's actually been pointed out that zodiac, the zoo may be part of that. I did some research on that. It looks like it's from the Greek word zoa. I think it's the Greek word zoa, but that means like life. So they look to the stars and the heavens for life in these pagan deities that they worship. It's pretty pitiful, but it's something that we see back at that time. And these little figurines, we can go down to the museum down the street and find these little figurines that have been dug up from years and years and years ago, thousands of years ago, in which the people put their trust in. Terrible. But the question I guess we need to ask is, did the Babylonian and Egyptian reckoning of the spring vernal equinox stem from Yahweh's directive found in Genesis? Now, the vernal equinox is defined as by Webster's Encyclopedic Unabridged Dictionary, the time when the sun crosses the plane of the Earth's equator, making night and day of approximately equal length all over the Earth, it says here. Basically about March 21st. And I guess we could say, well, after all, the Babylonians and Egyptians were using lights of the sun, moon, stars, just as Genesis 1:14 says. Yahweh said that they would be for signs, for seasons, for days, and for years. Yahweh also directed the seventh day, as mentioned, and we're not given all the information on the Sabbath in Genesis. We're not given all the information on how we are to do things in Genesis. We have the laws, in fact, even in the book of Numbers today, we read of different instructions. Is it possible? Could it be that Yahweh may have chosen a slightly different means for Israel since they were to be separate from the other nations? We read in Numbers 5. You can read in Leviticus 10:10, separating the clean from the unclean. Israel was to be separate from the other nations. And the other nations were all serving these pagan deities. When Israel was in Egypt, they would have known about the zodiac. They would have known about the vernal equinox. They would have known about these the other constellations and the pharaoh being a deity and all these type of things that they had in mind. But what does Yahweh tell us to do? And would Yahweh, have us observing some mechanism like that? In Deuteronomy 4:19, Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 19. Be aware not to lift up your eyes to heaven and see the sun and the moon and stars and all the hosts of the heavens and be drawn away and worship them and serve them. Those which Yahweh your Elohim has allotted to all the peoples under the whole heaven. Interesting. Has allotted to all the peoples under heaven. In one version, I think in the King James, it says divided. That word is basically given or allotted. So, you know, these stars in heaven have been given to mankind. Well, mankind has taken these stars and have come up with some astronomical type figures, but within their astronomy, they are mixing astrology. And math, you know, they're basically the priests of, they're Chaldeans of Babylon there, and some of these, in fact, you get into, well, maybe we don't need to go that far just yet, but we do find that they had all of these things intertwined, and I'm sure Yahweh was not happy with it all. But in ancient societies, it's no secret, stemming long ago from Sumerian, Akkadian civilizations, they literally worshipped the sun, moon, and stars. Ur, located in the lower area of Sumer, at the southwest end of the Persian Gulf Sea, is a city of the moon deity where Abram was originally called out. But later it was known as the city of the sun, according to the Armana letters. It actually refers to the city of Ur as the city of sun. And that may be due to a couple centuries that have passed in which the Ur had been taken over by Babylon. I mean, this is a possibility. In the Babylonian code of Hammurabi, Hanaki is mentioned. And basically, Hanaki is translated as the gods of the high sky. So there's a lot of pagan worship of the heavens, along with foretelling of the future, divination, astrology. And it was all there in ancient times. Regrettably, even Israel picked up on this at one time. Let's go over, maybe not just at one time, but a number of times. In Isaiah 47 and 13. You are wearied with your many counsels. Now let the astrologers, those who prophesy by the stars, those who predict the new moon, stand up and save you from what will come upon you. Now, it was not at all happy with them and took them and dispersed them. In Ezekiel 8, starting in verse 6, Ezekiel 8, 6. You may be familiar with this area. It's basically, this is a vision, but notice it's a vision of truth. This was stuff that was actually going on. And he said to me, Son of Man, talking to Ezekiel, Yahweh talking to him, said, Son of Man, do you see what they are doing, the great abominations that the house of Israel are committing here so that I would be far from my sanctuary? But yet you will see even greater abominations. Then he brought me to the entrance of the court, and when I looked, behold, a hole in the wall. And he said to me, Son of Man, now dig through the wall. So I dug through the wall, and behold the entrance. And he said to me, Go in and see what the wicked abominations and what they are doing here. So I entered, verse 10, I entered and looked, and behold, every form of creeping things, beast and detestable things, with all the idols of the house of Israel were carved on the wall all around. Now, I might just stop there and say that they have archaeological finds in the Egyptian walls of the astrological charts, the zodiac that they had there with the divisions. They also had Egyptian deities all the way around this cylinder, which was basically a 360 divisible through the constellations, and it's what they were doing. And so when I see here, it says, and I entered and looked, and behold, every form of creeping things. I mean, they have Scorpio, Scorpion, and these other type of constellations. I think it fits in line with what it says here in verse 10, that this may have actually been a constellation, a zodiac, of sorts that Ezekiel was taking a look at. And Yahweh was saying, this is what they're doing. Detestable. He says, so I entered and looked, and behold, every form of creeping things and beasts and detestable things, and with all the idols of the house of Israel, were carved on the wall all around. All around. Is that saying it's a cellar? I don't know. In verse 11, it says, standing in front of them were 70 elders of the house of Israel, with Jezaniah, the son of Japhet, standing among them, each man with a censer in his hand and the fragrance and the cloud of incense rising. Then he said to me, son of man, do you see what the elders of the house of Israel are committing in the dark, in secret? In other words, each man in the room of his carved images. For they say, Yahweh does not see us, and Yahweh has forsaken the land. So in other words, who cares? He's not coming. He's not bothering us. We're going to serve our little deities. And the sky gods, as they would have referred to them, I'm sure. Verse 13, he said to me, yet you will see still greater abominations which they are committing. Parable. Verse 14, when he brought me to the entrance of the gate of Yahweh's house, which was towards the north, and behold, women were sitting there weeping for Tammuz. Verse 15, and he said to me, do you see this, son of man? Yet you will see still greater abominations than these. And then he brought me into the inner court of Yahweh's house, and behold, at the entrance of the temple of Yahweh, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs to the temple of Yahweh and their faces toward the east, and they were prostrating themselves eastward toward the sun. Sun worshiping. Sun worshipers. Yahweh's people were sun worshipers, in other words. I mean, remarkable. Crazy. Insane all at the same time. You know, the math of, well, you know, the priests, even it looks like the priests of Yahweh, even in a sense, became astrologers. And to figure out all these patterns and stuff, they would have had to have been somewhat scientists and priests and astrologers and astronomers all rolled up in one. Now, going back to Babylon, back towards the east, which they were looking towards, it says, well, we find that the mathematical achievements of the Babylonians were quite impressive. They even had the basic 60-minute hour timed out, and they would have known of the vernal light equinox, too. Egypt also had capabilities with their water clocks and sundials. But they were also able to position large cut stones and they were able to do it in such a perfect way, both horizontally and vertically, by means of plumb lines and other string techniques, of course, to make the pyramids. But they evidently positioned them to be in line with certain star constellations and are said to have had the ability to determine the vernal equinox accurately. These four-sided upright granite obelisks, which they do find in the archaeological finds, are huge, so they kind of stand out. But they were strategically placed in certain locations to honor the rising of, as well as setting of the sun, their sun deity. It is noted in the Encyclopedia of Ancient Egypt by Margaret Bunsen that the Cairo calendar in particular was used in much the same way as horoscopes are used in modern times. And one of the archaeological finds they found was the zodiac of Zendera and some other things that are located in the Paris Museum in France. Let's go over to Ezra. This is going back to a time where Babylon is now allowing Judah to go home. And I think this is in, let's see. Let's go over to Nehemiah. I'm thinking Nehemiah chapter 8. Nehemiah chapter 8 is here where they're getting back into the groove of things, so to speak, when it comes to worshiping Yahweh. There's a couple things that they've learned in going into Babylonian captivity. One, you don't mess with Yahweh's Sabbaths. They were there because of the breaking a number of things, but one of the things that they broke was the sabbaticals. And so they were punished for a length of time, the amount of time that they had broken them, 490 years worth, 70 sabbaticals that they had broken. Now, when we look back at, I think it's King Josiah, we'll do that in a minute, but notice here that it's the seventh month that they've come back. Now, it's been speculated that they have accepted the Babylonian calendar system. In fact, no longer is the first month called Abib, it's now called Nisan. But I do think even when we refer to months here in our culture, we say January, February, March, April, May. We don't say one, two, the first, you know, well, we do. We do that as well. In a sense, we've got two calendars that we're looking at. We've got Yahweh's calendar on the one hand, in which we have to designate the appointed times that He has for us properly, so that we're not out of line with those. But on the other hand, we have this other calendar. It's a man-made calendar, but pretty accurate. They have the advanced technology now, the United States Naval Observatory, and, you know, with the Julian corrected under the Gregorian, we have, you know, a better calendar today. But we know that it has advanced from the trial and error that they went through in times past. But to say that the people are now under a Babylonian calendar and that that's okay, I find it it's a stretch. When the first of the year came around, they would have obviously started following Yahweh's instructions. They started following Yahweh's instructions here. And from the best of their ability, they kept it in the seventh month at that time. Now, when spring came around, they'd be doing things as Yahweh had instructed them. And we'll take a look at that, because I think that is key in understanding what Yahweh would have us to do. But notice in 2 Kings, hope this is not too boring. It's a lot of information to go through. But one of the reasons I wanted to go through it is, well, in part because this one individual that I was corresponding with got a bit offensive or offended, I think, when I said, you know, this vernal equinox and this zodiac stuff is from paganism. And he was taken aback by that. He said, well, no, you've got to look at Genesis 1:14. Clearly Yahweh wants it this way. Well, I think the instructions we find after Genesis gives us a clue as to what Yahweh wants. And, of course, we find information on the Sabbath and how to keep the Sabbath properly. And these other things. But in 2 Kings 23, I notice you all didn't laugh very loud when I said, I hope you're not getting bored. That tells me something. Maybe we can finish up here rather quickly. Yeah. 2 Kings 23, verse 5. I think some of the best messages I've heard in the past have been those that have been somewhat detailed. There's little gems of information that one can get. So we look for those gems. And here's one here. 2 Kings 23 and verse 5. Speaking of Josiah, King Josiah. Now King Josiah reigned for 31 years. He was a good king over Judah. And they had a number of good kings, but they had a number of bad ones too. After Josiah, they had four bad kings. But in 2 Kings 23:5, and remember we had talked about the people of Yahweh, not only the northern tribes, but the southern tribes as well, being disobedient. In 2 Kings 22:5, it says concerning Josiah, he did away with the idolatrous priest. Remember Ezekiel chapter 8. He did away with the idolatrous priest, whom the kings of Judah had appointed to burn incense in the high places in the cities of Judah and the surrounding area of Jerusalem. Also those who burn incense to Baal, to the sun, and to the moon, and to the constellations, and to the hosts of heaven. This was pretty prevalent at times throughout Israel's history. And he warned them, don't do that. But they did it. So after these, just four kings. Now, Josiah was a king for 31 years. And these other four kings that came in, they only lasted about 2.5 years. All four of them. I mean, one was out right after the other. And they just didn't last. Because Yahweh was tired of what he was saying, and they went backwards and not forwards. After Josiah, they went backwards. They stopped doing good. They stopped worshiping Yahweh properly. And so it's a lesson for us not to turn away or nor backslide into a former sinful lifestyle. Now, one thing that we do find is the advancement of calendars. Today we have the Naval Observatory. We can check and figure a number of things out today. The Mayan temples and culture are said to have produced one of the most accurate calendars of ancient societies. Their 365-day calendar is said by some today even more accurate than what we have now. I heard that just the other day by an individual. But the Mayan priests would go into the top of their ziggurat-shaped temples, and these are temples that are like a pyramid, only they're stair-stepped, very pronounced stair-stepped all the way to the top. And but yet they were hollow inside so they could go in. Well, at night they would go to the top, look up, and at night, or during the day, they would actually go inside and they would be able to see how the light of the sun would go on the floor. And they'd use a combination of this information, and they would use other things to come up with a calendar. And, of course, they've come up with this syndrilical calendar that shows the end of time is going to be 2012 on December 21st, which happens to be on a winter solstice. Go figure. Well, it's hard to say what will happen, but if Satan can maybe get in and do something, maybe that'll be the time that he'll try something. It's been theorized anyway. But the Mayan temples were quite the, and you can see the archaeological finds today. These Mayan priests would go in and do their thing. Now, as advances came during the Hellenistic era, they've actually found a device, a mechanical device, maybe around 150 to 100 BCE, and it has an estimated 29 plus moving parts. Estimated because the thing is frozen solid. They found it in a shipwreck that was heading towards Rome, but it's called the Antikythera mechanism. And it was evidently for determining astrological information. And it was quite the technology back at that time. It was like a watch. Now, another device with Greek lettering is the Byzantine sundial calendar, made roughly around 500 CE, which had only 8 years, but is able to provide dates by positioning the sun, moon among the zodiac. And, of course, today we have the Navy, the United States Naval Observatory, and the Gregorian calendar that's being used with its postponements. But what about Israel's year? What about the calendar that Yahweh told Israel to do? Let me count my pages. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, I got through 3 pages. Tell you what, let's go ahead and do a part 2 on this. So we'll come back at another time and look at these pagan calendars and how they've advanced into what we have today. But the question we have to ask ourselves is, do we do it man's way or do we do it Yahweh's way? And we'll take a look at some scriptures that will show just what Yahweh expects of us. May Yahweh bless you.